Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. All right, Exodus chapter 1. We're going to read Exodus chapter 1 here in just a minute, okay? But before we do, let's go over our memory verse for this month, which, by the way, this was unplanned as well. This was actually our key verse for VBS this week. And so, God works in mysterious ways. So this is obviously one of those, or when we don't even think he is. So let's read it together, and then we'll kind of get into our sermon this morning, all right? And remember, it's Colossians 1, 13 and 14, okay? So here we go. Colossians 1, 13 and 14. He has delivered us from the domain of darkness and has transferred us to the kingdom of His beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Colossians 1, 13 and 14. Very good, very good. All right, so this week we're going to kind of finish out or round out the series we've been on, which has been looking from a biblical worldview or from a kingdom perspective at government. And so what we've seen throughout this series is that government has a civil government, has a rightful spot in God's economy, just like the church does. Remember, Jesus says, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and render to God the things that are God's. Both have a rightful spot and both have an authoritative spot in God's economy. The church over spiritual, moral sphere of life, government over civil life. Last week, we saw that as Christ followers, our role is to willingly place ourselves under the authority of government. And government's function is to do two things, all right? Is to do two things. To punish the wicked and to reward the good. So punish those who do evil and reward those who do good, all right? Now, however, history has shown us, or I shouldn't say however, because that means like I'm going to say something contrary to what the Bible says. That's not what I'm going to say. No heresy this morning. But, or in what we know from history, maybe a better way to say it, is that sometimes government gets it wrong. Amen. Right? Sometimes, maybe we should say a lot of times, government gets it wrong. History is replete with examples of how government has done horrendous things and has swapped up spheres or combined the two spheres in which God's economy functions. And so today, we're going to look at one example from the Bible when government gets it wrong, and also at the same time look at
don't you fall in that.
I appreciate it. Brother Joe helping me out this morning. That cord. I was trying to move it with my feet, but
I saw it, I didn't even see it.
Oh well, thank you, Miss Reba. Thank you, Brother Joe. All right, so what we're gonna do is we're gonna look at one example of where government gets it wrong. And then at the same time, look at how people who have look at life from a biblical view, what they do. And we're going to ask this crucial question. Were they right in their response? All right. Now, in order to look at this story from Exodus 1, we actually need to go all the way back to about the middle of Genesis, because our story really starts in the middle of Genesis. But fear not, we're not going to read all that. I'm going to explain it very, very briefly. About halfway through the book of Genesis, or about a third of the way through the book of Genesis, the story focuses, the first third of Genesis is very high level. God created the world. God works in the world. There's a flood. God works after the flood. But about a third of the way through Genesis, God begins, he's working on a macro level, but he hones in on one man in his family, and that guy is Abraham. And God says, Abraham, I'm going to call you out of all the nations, and you're going to be my chosen people, and I'm going to bless you with a son, and your offspring will be as many as the stars in the sky, the sands on the sea, and through you all nations will be blessed. And miraculously, Abraham has a son. His name's Isaac. And then Isaac has two sons, Jacob and Esau. Esau's the older, so it should have been Abraham, Isaac, and Esau. But through some various events, it's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the younger son, which would have been totally out of character, but in God's providence and God's sovereignty, it's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so the story follows Jacob. And Jacob has a lot of kids. A lot. Like 12. Right? And we all catch our breath for a minute. And Jacob has a favorite. Now, I know none of you parents had favorite kids, because you all love your kids equally. Right? But I hope you do. All right? I mean, I saw some smirks. Right? Oh, wait a minute. But Jacob has a favorite, and his favorite is Joseph. And Jacob makes it known that Joseph is his favorite. And since Jacob's favorite is Joseph, Joseph plays that card really well. And guess what? His other siblings don't like it. So they want to kill him. And instead of killing him, they throw him in a deep pit. And then they're going to kill him, but they got to figure out how to do it. But then one of them says, let's don't do that. Let's just sell him to slave traders. So that's what happens. They sell him to slave traders, and the slave traders take him down to Egypt, and through a miraculous set of events, he goes from being a slave to being in prison and forgotten about to rising up to the top tier of command of the entire Egyptian empire. And through an even more miraculous, God-ordained and inspired set of events, Jacob is reunited with his father and all of his brothers and their wives and all of their kids through a miraculous set of events. They are reunified as one family and they live in Egypt. And at the end of Genesis, it tells us they multiply miraculously and they thrive in the land of Egypt. And that brings us to Exodus chapter 1, verse 8. Now here's how we're going to do this. We're going to read a little bit of the passage. And then we're going to talk about it. Then we're going to read a little bit more of the passage and talk about it, okay? So we're going to read and talk. So here we go, verse 8. Now there arose a king over Egypt, this is crucial, who did not know Joseph. What that means is he didn't know Joseph the person, and he didn't know what Joseph had done, and he didn't know Joseph's people. As we'll see in the story, neither did he care about Joseph's people. So new leadership, it doesn't matter how new leadership came to be in Egypt. Was it a coup? Was it this portion over to, it doesn't matter. A new king arose, a new pharaoh arose in Egypt who did not know Joseph or his people. Verse 9. And he said, that's the pharaoh, that's the king. And he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set, that's the Egyptians, therefore the Egyptians set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, so cities that housed grain or supplies in Pithom and in Ramses. All right, so here was the plan. New leadership comes into power and they're like, look, we have to do something with these Israelites because one, there's too many of them. Two, they multiply quickly. So in a few years, there will be even more than there are now. And worse than all of that, they fear that if given the opportunity, the Israelites will help an invading army overthrow the Egyptians. And whoever the Pharaoh is now will lose all of his power. So they come up with a plan. And the plan is, we Egyptians are going to set bosses or taskmasters over you guys, and you guys are going to do what we tell you to do. Now, they're not yet slaves. It's more like, think of maybe like indentured servitude. You don't really have a choice, but you're a little bit better, right? However, as great as this plan sounds for the Egyptians, it doesn't quite go the way they think it will. Verse 12. But the more they were oppressed, the more the Israelites, the descendants of Jacob and of Joseph, the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So the harder they pressed them, the more they grew. So they ruthlessly, look, here's the change. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves. So they went from free people to like indentured servitude kind of to slaves. And made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. Right? So you should get the picture. New king comes in. We got to deal with this issue. They try to deal with this issue in one way. That issue doesn't work. And so they try to deal with them. They deal with them even more ruthlessly. And that doesn't even work. And so, as we transition to verse 15, one more modern dictator would call this solution a final solution. Then the king of Egypt said to Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, remember that name, Shiphrah, the other Puah, Shiphrah and Puah. All right, now midwives. Midwives are common today, right? Midwives helped in the birthing process. However, probably unlike today, these were ladies who either A, weren't married, or who couldn't or didn't have kids. So they helped other people have kids. Got me? All right. So this is the bottleneck. This is the system. This is the bottleneck of the system that Pharaoh is going to attack. It's the weakest link between how he can finally solve this Hebrew birth baby explosion problem, okay? Here's what he tells them. When you serve as midwives to the Hebrew women and you see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. Let it sink in. You shall kill him. But if it's a daughter, they shall live. Now, let's capture that for just a moment, okay, before we read the next verse. Why would Pharaoh do that? Simply, if you only have one sex or gender, you cannot repopulate within your own. So if he kills all the baby boys, then the only young men who are of eligible age for these women to marry are Egyptians. And over time, guess what happens? You have no more Israelites. And so it's a long game process. But if you can kill all the baby boys of one generation, then you don't have another generation eventually. And so that's his plan. Verse 17. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king commanded them, but let the male children live. All right, so here's the question. All right, so verse 17. We're going to hang out in verse 17 for just a minute. All right, so verse 17 says, they did not do what the king commanded. Now, all right, so here's the quandary, okay? You ready? What did we say last week? We're to willingly put ourselves under the supervision, direction, directives of the government, right? What Paul says is what Peter says. But here today, we have people, the midwives, who are actively not doing what the government says, willfully not putting themselves under the directives. Why? Because they feared God. So the question we've got to ask, and I know you're already like, well, yeah, of course they shouldn't have. But what I want to challenge you today with is, why were they right? Were they right? And if they were, why were they right not to follow the government? The Pharaoh called these two people in. Might I remind you that the Egyptians viewed their Pharaoh as God incarnate. Like this was God on earth. Like one wave of a finger and you're dead. One move of the staff and you're dead. One word and you don't exist anymore. So were they right? Now I know the knee-jerk reaction is yes, but if they are, why were they right? Because you need to know the answer to that. Because the next time you all go willy-nilly on me and say, I'm not doing what they tell me to do. Why aren't you going to do what they tell you to do? Because if you don't know the why answer, then you're just going off your feeling and your gut. And let's be honest, your feeling and your gut's messed you up just as much as mine has mine. Mine has me. Right? Feelings are fickle, and emotions can lead us down a dangerous path. So let's dive in. Let's dive into it. From my examination, based off of what we've learned so far in the rest of the scripture, I would agree that yes, Shiphrah and Puah were right in their examination that the Egyptian government had failed to meet the criteria that God had called them to and were correct to disobey. And here's the two reasons, okay? And listen to me. Here's the two reasons. The first reason is that the Egyptian government, that Pharaoh specifically, had failed to appropriate his function of punishment and reward correctly. Now remember, what did we say that government's function was? It is to reward the doers of good and to punish the doers of evil. Now let me ask you a question. It's an easy question. You don't have to answer out loud, but you can if you want to. Have these baby boys done anything wrong against the state? No. Absolutely not. No baby that has ever been birthed has done anything wrong against the state. Right? So what was Pharaoh doing? Pharaoh was saying that by being birthed, they were guilty of wickedness and evil, and therefore deserved to be punished. Now that's ludicrous, right? I mean, can we not all agree on that? That's crazy talk. Why in the world would any government ever think a baby had done anything wrong deserving of death? That's stupid. I mean, it's insane. But Pharaoh said that these kids, by being born, they were as guilty as the someone who had committed murder. Listen to this. Joseph, you can go back and read this. Joseph, the guy I mentioned at the beginning, Joseph is falsely accused of a heinous crime of rape. And you know what his sentence is? He gets thrown in jail. That's his sin. He gets convicted, even though it's falsely he didn't do it. He gets convicted of rape and is thrown in an Egyptian prison where he languishes for like 12 years. And yet, these babies haven't done anything wrong. And they are treated worse than the person, even though falsely convicted of rape. Do you not see the disparity there? Now, yes, Joseph was falsely convicted. But these babies haven't done anything. They were simply guilty of being born. And Pharaoh says, death. So why were Shiphrah and Puah right? One, because the Egyptian government got their function backwards. Backwards. And might I add, this is just another little passing blow. Pharaoh didn't even have the guts to do it himself. He didn't even have the guts to send in his own people to do it. He tried to hire it out to other people to do it. Just be a man about it, Pharaoh. If you think this is the solution, then get your own people to do it. But he doesn't even do that. But there's another thing. There's another thing that the government gets it wrong on. So not only do they get their function and role of punishment and reward wrong, they also step outside of their sphere and into God's sphere. Because here's what happens. We've said that government has a rightful spot so long as they stay in their area of control, which is civil life. But by saying that babies, by being born, are bad, you've stepped out of a civil life, stepped out of the sphere of civil life, and you've stepped into the moral, spiritual aspect, which Pharaoh had no governmental say-so to do. Because here's what he was saying. Listen to me. Here's what he was saying. He was saying that Egyptian boys are good. Israelite boys are bad. But God doesn't make that distinction, does he? God's the moral arbiter of good and bad. The reason you know what's good and you know what's bad is based off of what God says is good and what God says is bad. And nowhere prior to this and nowhere after this does God say Egyptians are good and Israelites are bad. That's a moral decision. Right? In fact, in Genesis 1:26, you know what God says? All people, humanity, is created in whose image? My image. God's image. Right? That's what God says. Humanity is created in my image. He doesn't say Egyptian humanity is created in my image. He doesn't say Israelite humanity is created in my image. He doesn't say American people are created in my image. He says all of humanity is created in my image. Therefore, the Egyptian government is making a distinction based off race that God doesn't make, or ethnicity that God doesn't make. And they are calling one good and one bad. And that's the distinction that God doesn't make. And so the Egyptian government, whose sphere is civil life, steps out of that and says, we are now going to make a moral distinction between these babies and these babies. And that is not a decision that they are responsible or able or should make as well. Is everybody with me so far? So let's go over it. So one, the fatal flaw number one that the Egyptians make is they don't use punishment and reward correctly. Instead of punishing evildoers, they're punishing innocents. And instead of staying in civil life, they move over and make an error in moral judgment. Right? And so Shiphrah and Puah, but the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt, as Pharaoh commanded, but they let the male children live. Now, how does the story end? Let's keep reading. So the Egyptian king, so Pharaoh called the midwives in. Now this is miraculous to me, because they should have never made it out alive. Let's just be clear. They should never have made it out alive. So the king called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this? And let the male Israelite children live. Why'd you let them boys live? I told you to kill them. Why'd you let them live? Listen to what they say. This is amazing. And the midwife said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. I mean, hey, look, I put it this way. If we're going to die, we're going to go out swinging. Right? Because he just said, our ladies are better than yours. For they are vigorous in giving birth before the midwife comes to them. Right? I mean, look, they know what's going to happen going in. We're going to go into the desert. Nobody's going to see us again. And so this to me is like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know what? If today's our day, we're going to go out with gusto. And so they're like, miraculously though, they make it out. Pharaoh doesn't kill them. They make it out, because there's some more verses. Let's read. This story's not over yet. So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them what? The one thing they didn't have: families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, that's the Israelites, you shall cast them in the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. So what's the final, what's the response that comes out? What's the result? So one is for the Israelites, one is for the midwives. The midwives who didn't have families now have families, and God richly blesses them. But because of their obedience, God blesses the entire nation as well. And might I add that Exodus 1:22 sets us up for the next major move of God in history. And it's the move that the whole book is named after. Because if you don't know what happens in chapter 2, you should read what happens in chapter 2. Because an Israelite family has a little baby and they name him Moses. And they put him in a basket and they float him down the river. And Pharaoh's daughter, who wants to kill all the Hebrews, finds the baby and wants to adopt the baby. And then through some miraculous set of events, the baby's, Moses' mother actually raises the baby, and then Moses leads the entire Israelites out of Egypt into the desert where they're formed as a nation. And they wander around a little bit, and they finally make it to the promise, make it back to the land that Abraham started from hundreds of years before. And it's all because, in some sense, because God was working in and through these two ladies that set up the move of God in an entire nation. Now, all right, so we got it. That's kind of the story. So now we need to get to the point where that's a great story, and we saw that they did right, but how do we, what do we gain from this story? How do we apply this story? Where does it go for us? Okay, and so the next few minutes that we've got, or the last like 12 minutes we've got together, I want to kind of give you four application points, okay, that I think we can take home with us today. All right, number one, how do we apply this story to our own life? Here's the first thing, and I think this is the most obvious, right? God's law always takes priority. God's law always. So here's what I mean. Remember I showed you about 3 or 4 weeks ago, we said there are several ways through which you can view life. You can view life through reason and logic, what makes sense to you. You can view life through experience, how have I experienced things. You can view life through tradition. You can view life through society and culture. Or you can view life through the Bible. Remember that? There's a little Pentagon thing. And I said that as Christians, we should always view the life through the lens of the Bible first and foremost. And we see that played out here because what takes priority? God's law. God says humanity is worth living. That you shouldn't kill babies that haven't done anything wrong. Like that's immoral. Why do they say that? Because God's law takes priority. And looking at life through God's law. If you looked at this scenario through reason and logic, what would you say? Hey, Pharaoh's going to kill me if I don't do this. I got to do it. As much as I don't want to do it, I got to do it. Tradition may say, well, this is not what I do, but it may be what they do. So, society and culture, look out for number one. Do what you got to do. But when you look at this situation through the lens of the Bible, they can't do it. Because God's law always takes priority first. Here's the second thing. When government gets their responsibility wrong, you can and should make that known. Right? You can and should. Now, I'm not saying you have to, but you can. And you, in some senses, you absolutely should. I know this is an extreme example, right? There have been other extreme examples throughout governments across the world and even in ours in history. When government gets it wrong, you have the responsibility to say, hey, that's not right. Here's why it's not right. Don't just say it's not right because you don't like the person who's in the office making the decisions. That's a lame excuse. Just because I didn't vote for the person means I don't like what they're doing. That's lame. That's weak, and that's a terrible argument. You've got to know why you don't agree with it. Well, I don't agree with it because I didn't like it. No. If the midwives go in and say, well, I'm not doing it because I don't like this Pharaoh. I like the old Pharaoh, and I want the old Pharaoh back. That's not a good excuse. They didn't do it because they didn't like him. They did it because it violated God's law. That's different. When government gets their responsibility wrong, you can and should make that known. But let me, number three, caution you before you do. And let me encourage you. Listen. Rubber's really meeting the road here. We're laying some streaks down. Listen to me. You better count the cost. You better count the cost. Because not all stories end like Shifra and Pua. Let me give you two. One may be very common. You may not know the other one. There's a very famous author and Christian leader in Germany in the 1940s, last name was Bonhoeffer, right? Bonhoeffer. Wrote some amazing books. You may have read them. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran theologian, pastor, who vehemently opposed the Nazi regime. So much so that they actually imprisoned the dude in 1943. And after they imprisoned the dude, they found out that he was actually actively engaged in a plot not only to overthrow the Nazi regime, but to kill Hitler. Which from our perspective seems like a great idea. Let's just be honest. Guess how it turned out for Bonhoeffer? He didn't make it out. When they found out that he was actually engaged in an active plot not only to overthrow the government but to kill Hitler, they killed him. You better count the cost. There's a great book that if you haven't read, I would encourage you to read it. It's called Back to Jerusalem. I think the author has actually written a second book as well. I read this book in seminary, Back to Jerusalem. It's about the underground house church movement in China in the late 90s, kind of early 2000s, kind of that time frame. Back to Jerusalem. Because see, there is what we would call colloquially an above ground church in China, but it's controlled by the state. Sure, you can preach Jesus-y loosely from the pulpit, but you can only meet on certain times and certain places, and you can never grow above a certain population in your church. So a lot of the church leaders have gone underground, and some of them literally underground. Okay? Some of them, that's a euphemistic name, but some of them literally meet underground. And the story tells, the book is about story after story after church leaders, pastors like myself, who have been thrown in prison multiple times, who have to live, listen to me, who have to live like squatters in abandoned apartment buildings because nobody will even rent them a place to live. Because they don't want to be associated with the pastor who's leading people to Jesus who's been thrown in jail because they too might be thrown in jail. Right? I'm just telling you. You have the responsibility when government gets it wrong to say something. But listen to me. You better count the cost. Because you and I, listen, and this is, you say, oh, that will never happen in America. It has happened recently. Now, we may disagree or agree on some of this stuff, but there have been people who may not have been killed physically, but their business has been killed because they were on social media, and the social media tycoons out there have said, oh, we don't want that kind of message. We don't want that. So we're just going to deplatform you, and we're going to make it impossible for you to do business. That's similar, not the same, but it's on the same road, right? So I'm just telling you, count the cost and know what you're getting into before you get into it. Because not every story ends like Schiffer and Poop. But here's the thing, let me before we go on to our last point, but let me tell you this. Schiffer and Pua didn't know how the story was going to end until it ended. Listen to me. They didn't know they were going to make it out of Pharaoh alive. They didn't know that God was going to give them families until he did. They made up their mind well before that they were not going to do what Pharaoh said. And they were going to let the boys live. They made up their mind they were going to be obedient regardless of what the results were. And so if we're going to try to be obedient, hedging our bets that we're going to make it out alive, then listen to me, at some point you're not going to do it. Because if you're hedging your bets up here that obedience is kind of if I'm obedient and it works out, I'll kind of keep going, or if the tides are kind of in my favor, then at some point you're not going to do it. Schiffer and Pua made up their mind well before the results came in that they were going to be obedient to the Lord. Right? Now here's the final thing. And all of this, and I would say this will apply to what we're going to start next week. In all of this, listen to me, we've got to remember that our first priority is the advancement of God's kingdom, not our own. And that can be our own little acreage of land that we live on. It can be our own kingdom if we want to term that as Valley Grove's kingdom. We can look at that through the eyes of America, right? Sure, we should help our government be the best that it can be. Absolutely. That's what we've been talking about the last 3 weeks. But if we ever get to the point where we put all of our eggs in the basket of government, we've missed the point. The point is, yes, to help government get better and do right things and honor God. But governments, let me just put it this way. Jesus isn't coming back for the government. He's coming back for the church. Right? Look. We're like 3 weeks away from July 4th. Pastor Jacob's going to be preaching that Sunday. I'm going to be laid out at the beach in the sun. I love y'all. And he'll do a fabulous job. But I'm going to be at the beach getting sun, enjoying my freedom and my liberty at the beach, listening to the waves and the wind with the other 10,000 people that are going to be there. All right? And as much as we love America and as much as we... Jesus didn't come back for America. He's come back for the church. Whether the church is here or in China or in India or in Europe or in Africa or in South America. And so listen to me. If we ever get to the point where we're more concerned about government than we are about the gospel, we've kind of got misplaced priorities. So if your Facebook feed begins to look like a lot of recurring posts from CNN and MSNBC and Fox News and this political and this, and less and less about Jesus and the gospel. Come on. Now look, you can use Facebook for either or. I'm just telling you, I know Mark Zuckerberg and whatever the dude from Twitter, I know they didn't create that for a gospel sharing platform, but doggone it, you could absolutely use it for that. Right? And so you got a choice. We've all got a choice. So your challenge today is kind of threefold. And I don't know where this is going to hit. So I came up with three vastly different challenges this week. So maybe it'll be for somebody. Are you willing to hold the government accountable, whether you voted for the person or not? Maybe I should phrase it this way. Are you willing to hold the person accountable even if you voted for them? Because what our usual habit is we hold the person we didn't vote for more accountable than the person we did. Right? Have you counted the cost for having a biblical worldview of government, even if that means speaking out against misappropriations of authority? Lastly, here's your challenge. Are you advancing the gospel as much as you are griping about government misappropriation? Right? Because look, we've all heard it today. You may have even said it this morning. Oh, that's bad. Right? But are we asking, hey, how can I share Jesus with that person? How can I, God, define my area of influence and help me figure out a way to minister to those people? Because that's really where our main focus should be.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.